Hey, everybody, and welcome to the UFC Fight Night Anderson versus Błachowicz 2 dissection. And this fucking fight card is stacked. I'm really excited for the one for this fight coming up this weekend. This is one of those ones where, unfortunately, I have a fucking appointment to get work done on my tattoo at like noon, mountain time. So I'm going to miss like probably the first half of the prelims, unfortunately. But if I had an entire day to dedicate to watching fights, this would be a great fucking card to do it. Because if you're a hardcore MMA fan, you recognize every single name on the list. And if you are relatively new to watching it or just getting into it, this is a great card because you got some familiarity, you got some seasoned veterans, and you also got some guys who are like in the middle, and then you got some guys who are really promising and are trying to bust through and like make their way into the top 15, top 10, right? So it not only gives you like the sense of familiarity when you're watching it with guys like Jim Miller and guys like Diego Sanchez and guys like John Dodson, right? Tim Means, all vets. But you also have guys like Scott Holtzman, Nathaniel Wood, Michel Pereira, you know, I mean, Macy Chiasson, all these people on here that are phenomenal fighters that are kind of, they're going to give you a sense of where MMA is probably trending towards, like the direction it's heading in. So like I said, if you're a hardcore MMA fan, this is a great fight because you're going to probably love all the fights on it, all the matchups. And if you're not, good one to get started in because it's going to give you a good introduction to all of these fucking fighters. So anyway, whole card is going to air on ESPN Plus starting at 5 p.m. Eastern time. Mark De La Hoza kicks things off against Rolion Paiva. Macy Chiasson fights Shannon Young after that. Mirab Davalishvili, really talented, fighting Casey Kenney. Casey Kenney has actually picked up a big win over Ray Borg, who's on the headline, who's on the main card. Devin Clark fighting Daquan Townsend. Devin Clark, a guy with a lot of power, good wrestling base. Daquan Townsend just fought Bayvon Lewis a month ago. Scott Holtzman versus Jim Miller. Jim Miller is obviously a black belt, recently fought off Lyme's disease, has, I mean, a wealth of MMA knowledge, and he's going to be putting it to the test against a guy in Scott Holtzman who is extremely dangerous and very gritty, fights with a lot of tenacity. And if you go back and watch his fight against Alon Patrick, the push-off, the elbows that he landed to end that fight were brutal. Some of the best examples of push-off elbows I've ever seen. And then probably the most intriguing matchup on the prelim card to me is John Dodson versus Nathaniel Wood. Nathaniel Wood is a rising prospect at 135 pounds, very well-rounded. And John Dodson is another one of those guys, man, who, like we talked about earlier, seasoned veteran. So this is going to be one of the – he's seen some of the most dangerous guys in the world at that weight class, both at 135 and 125. So this is going to be a good – like indicator of where Nathaniel Wood's at and where he's ready to go, where his career is ready to trend towards, right? Like, is he going to be moving up to fight a lot of these guys in the top 10, or is he need a little bit more molding before he's ready for that? Tim Means is headlining the prelims against Daniel Rodriguez. And then you get to the main card, Yancy Medeiros, Lana Venata, Rogerio Bontorum, and Ray Borg. Cazula Vargas versus Brock Weaver. Mauro Romero Barella versus Montana De La Hoza. Michel Pereira versus Diego Sanchez. And then headlining it all, Corey Anderson and Jan Błachowicz are rematching. So, like I said, great fucking fight card. But before we get into breaking the main card down, it would be impossible to move forward with this podcast and not talk about what happened last weekend with John Jones versus Dominic Reyes. And this is how I feel. I feel that using the current criteria, Dominic Reyes won the first three rounds. He did more damage. His shots that he were landing were more significant. They seemed to be hurting John a little bit. They were backing him up. I know that John was applying constant forward pressure, but to me, that gets null. If there's like a really close round or a really close fight, that can be a deciding factor, like where you don't really know who won. But when you've got a guy who's landing more significant shots and hurting you and landing with head kicks and he knocks you down in the first round, I mean, like, to me, it was pretty obvious that Dominic, using the current criteria, won the first three rounds. I thought he did. I don't know. I don't think it was robbery. I think that that third round is a little bit subjective. But I think if you gave the first two rounds to John, you don't know what the fuck you're watching. I'm just being honest. I think that the toss-up round was round three. I think John won rounds four and five. But if you're using the current scoring criteria, I give it to Dominic Reyes. I think he just barely won, and the third round was closer, but I still think he did a little more, right? Okay, so my main problem, I mean, the guy who gave it 49-46 to John, ridiculous. A lot of things to talk about here and unpack, kind of. First, I want to start with, like, the idea that in order to beat the champ, you need to beat the champ. That's dumb. That shit is one of the... I hate that fucking saying. Like, to say that you go through all these rising contenders, right, and that you earn a title shot finally, and that you finally have proven to yourself that you're worthy to fight the guy who holds the belt, now you're not allowed to just beat him marginally. You have to dominate him in order to win the belt. That makes zero fucking sense. Scoring should be consistent in that regard across the board, whether it's a three-round fight or whether it's a five-round title fight. Doesn't matter. You should be being objective about the outcome of the fight. I don't believe in that shit where you say, oh, you have to go out and dominate the champ and do this to him and do that to him or knock him out. No, that's fucking bullshit. That's some of the stupidest shit I've ever heard in my life. You should be viewing the fight as if neither of them have a belt and they're just fighting, and you should give the winner of the fight the victory accordingly, right? Now, so that's how I feel about that, or like, statement. Like, just because you hold the belt doesn't mean that you automatic. That's like giving him free points. I mean, that's really what it's like. That's like saying, okay, well, yeah, you might have won, but like, he's the champ. Like, you, so what? He just gets free points? You're saying that the rounds don't start off even? That's ludicrous. It's like giving someone extra when they start the fight. It's like giving the champion a head start, which is total bullshit. Both guys prepared for the fight. Both guys made their way to the fight. They both stepped into the octagon. They both cut weight. It should be fucking completely and entirely objective. All right, so that statement pisses me off every time I hear it. Second, and you'll hear guys like John Kavanaugh and Joe Rogan talk about this, and they, in my opinion, are 100. Now, this is going to lead into what I think is wrong with the scoring system, but they're 100% right. I think that rounds 4 and 5 should mean more, right? And this is why. Not only if you're approaching the end of the fight are you getting closer to simulated death and exhaustion between the two, but also in the first, like, the problem with scoring is that you are scoring it live, right? Like, when round one's over, you have to give a score for round one. When round two is over, you have to give a score for round two. When round three is over, you got to, I mean, all the way through five, right? The problem with that is that scoring fights does not have the gift of hindsight. Like, you don't have that gift. So you can't look at rounds 4 and 5 and look at what's working and go back and change your score for rounds 1, 2, and 3. And let me kind of elaborate on what I mean. So John, throughout the duration of the fight, applied constant pressure. And while he weathered the storm from Dominic Reyes early, right? So while on paper and using our current scoring system, he might have won, or he might have lost those rounds, the dividends of that constant forward pressure and constant kicks and volumes, he might not have been landing the bigger shots, but you got to see that towards the end of the fight in rounds 4 and 5, John's strategy was ultimately better than Dominic's. He started to reap the benefits and, I mean, really get rewards out of the seeds that he planted in the first 3 rounds, even though he might have lost those rounds. And then in championship rounds 4 and 5, like I said, you're starting to reap the benefits of those, and you got to see, like, oh, wait, yeah, what Dominic Reyes did in rounds 1 through 3, extremely good. I mean, impressive, man. He was hurting John. But as the fight wore on, didn't really matter. Nothing that Dominic did early in the fight paid dividends later in the fight where they did for John. And I'll give you another example. Colby Covington versus Kamaru Usman. Colby Covington may have had rounds where he definitely won and outstruck and, you know, I mean, rocked Kamaru Usman. Like, there were definitely moments in the fight where it went that way. But Kamaru Usman religiously dug the body with that front kick over and over and over again. And even though Kamaru Usman may have been losing those rounds, in the 5th round when he knocked Colby Covington out, you got to see the dividends that the body shots played in him, like, being able to execute his game plan. So while he might not have been winning the round as it was live, the seeds that he were planting with those front kicks paid off in the later rounds. And like I said, there's no real way to go back and sort of there's no way to go back and change your score for the first three rounds after knowing that what John did paid off later. So that's another argument for adding more weight to the end of the rounds, right? And this is how I kind of think MMA should be scored. And I've said this before on this podcast. This is how I feel about it, right? I think that when you have a 10-9 system, it makes it easy in a very close fight to just kind of say, well, I think this guy won. I'm going to give him 10 points and the other guy 9. Fuck it. Not a lot of thinking involved in it, right? So that's a problem. You obviously have incompetent judges, but when people can just mark down 10-9, and I mean, for a fight to be a 10-8, for you to get that gap, it has to be glaringly obvious. Like, I think about 10-8s, if you have a friend with you who has never watched fighting in their life or doesn't understand fighting, and they're able to watch a fight and decide who won without saying, like, I think, like, if they definitively know who won, that's probably a 10-8 round on most scorecards. And the problem with that is that it's so obvious, and it doesn't take into consideration all of the nuances and all of the, like, different things that you can do in MMA, like submitting, like, weighing submission attempts, and, like, there are different, there's, like, even in an attempt, there are, like, different levels of effectiveness. Like, if you're just trying a guillotine and the guy slips out and he ends up in your guard and starts punching you in the face, that submission attempt is not as, like, it's not as important as if you took some, it doesn't count for as much, in my opinion, as if you took someone's back and failed to rear naked choke them, because in one instance you had to work all the way to the back, the other you might have just hopped up and pulled guard. So, I mean, there are little nuances like that all through MMA, all through it. And I think what you need to reflect, to accurately reflect what's happening is you, because, like, the other problem too is that a lot of 10-9 rounds aren't the same. Like, you might get a guy who, let's say two guys fight, and the guy in the blue corner wins the first round, but you're like, oh man, that's a close fucking fight. I mean, he just barely won. That's a 10-9. The other guy in the red corner might come out in round two and pick up a bigger, he might win, and he might win by a wider margin than the guy in the first round won, but it's going to still be a 10-9 on the scorecard unless it was glaringly obvious that he dominated. So you've got the same score for two rounds, and that's not accurate. This is just a proposal, and I've been saying it for a while, and it's kind of on loose legs, but I think about it a lot. And I think about guys like Yoel Romero who are religiously robbed of, like, fights that he probably won the fight as a whole but lost the round by round based on the criteria, right? I think what you do is you have 10 total points available, okay, for every round. And let's say that a guy, and you should, you can scale this however you want. I'm using 10 because I'm a fucking idiot and can't add quickly, right? But let's say that a guy just narrowly wins a round. I mean, it's fucking razor thin. You might score that round 5.5 to 4.5, right? Now, in the same scenario we were talking about earlier, the guy in the other corner comes out and wins that round a little bit more significantly. Now maybe he got a 6-4 round. So now, I mean, you've got 6.5 plus 4.5, you've got 10.5, and 5.5 plus 4 is 9.5. The guy who came out and had the bigger second round is actually winning the fight, as he should be, because he won by a wider margin than the guy who won the first round won. Does that make sense? Is this making sense? And then maybe the way you compensate for, like, championship rounds and weighting them differently is in rounds 4 and 5, maybe you have 20 points available. And maybe that way, like, you can drive, like, I mean, in that case, it would be like, say one guy goes out and wins, like, a fairly, like, he definitely won the round, right? Maybe you score that 12-8. And now your point margin is wider because you've gotten into the championship rounds, and it, like, kind of simulates that weight that we were talking about that rounds 4 and 5 should have. So you get, like, as you increase the number, you get a wider margin for the championship rounds that can be added on. I think that makes the most sense, honestly. I mean, I know that's on loose legs, but I really think that would work. I think that, like, if you had the first three rounds be scored with, like, a 10-point gap, or 10 total points available, and then the last two rounds there were 20 points available, your incentive to widen that margin because there are more points available and further your lead is much greater. And those rounds are more important because Not only are you you're simulating the end of a fight to the death, but you're also starting to see, like, in a 4- and 5-round fight is when you really start to see who, like, has the championship mentality and who has been, like I said, reaping the benefits of everything that they did, all the little things they did in rounds 1, 2, and 3. That's my personal take on it. Anyway, let's move on into some news. Big fight matchup over in Bellator. Douglas Lima is going to be challenging Gegard Mousasi for the vacant middleweight title. And if you guys are fans of, like, Joe, I mean, if you're watching me, you probably know who Joe Rogan is, right? But he had Rafael Lovato Jr. on there, who is taking a leave of absence from MMA due to some, like, brain-related issues. So hope he gets better. I'm only, like, a third of the way through the podcast, so I don't know everything, and I definitely don't have the name of, like, the disease or whatever it is memorized. But it leaves this vacancy in the middleweight division for Bellator, and this is kind of interesting because Douglas Lima is going to be trying to do what Rory McDonald cannot do in challenging for the 185-pound belt. And in that fight against Gegard and Rory, you kind of saw, like, man, size matters. And a 15-pound jump at a high level is it's a big jump. I mean, Gegard was significantly bigger, more powerful, and was just able to control things in the Rory McDonald fight. And it makes you wonder, maybe if it speaks to a little bit of the lack of depth at 185 for Bellator, that Douglas Lima, his first, he's not even doing a title defense after beating Rory, is moving up to fight Gegard. Probably two of the biggest names in the organization, though, and it is an interesting fight because you got to consider where Rory's headspace was at after, you know, like the John Fitch fight. He announces all this stuff, and it's like, ugh, what's going on? What's going on, Rory? I mean, you know, so I don't know. I personally, like, when I hear about matchups like this, I lean towards Gegard. It just, it's, if you're fighting and you're both high level, it's an advantage to be bigger. I really think so. Some example, like, one of the probably, like, thinnest lines there is when you see guys jump from, like, light heavyweight to heavyweight, and they're already, like, pretty big guys, so they stack on some weight and might have a little bit of a cardio and speed advantage. Like, it's kind of like the bigger you get, the less pronounced it is. But, like, if a 135 or if a 125er fought like a 155er, you'd be like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Or even if a 125er fought like a guy who weighed like 145 pounds, you know? Anyway, but that's a good fight. There were a couple notable UFC releases too. UFC trimmed the roster up a little bit. Junior Albiti was released. Nathan Coy, Brandon Davis, which is surprising because if you watch Brandon Davis fight, he's really fucking good. That's a shame. I hope he makes his way back. Kalindra Faria, Grigory Popov, and another one, Juan Adams, was just released after his loss to Justin Toffa last weekend, and Brad Katona was let go too. And Brad Katona is one of those guys who, man, when I watch him every single time, I go, fuck, that kid is good. He's good. He's got the right mentality. He does small things right. Like, a lot of, if you want to watch, like, for guys who are going to be championship caliber, it's not just about being talented. It's about your mindset. And I like how Katona, even when he's put into negative situations, he's always fighting to correct, even if he's not winning the exchanges. And he has a high fight IQ. He knows when to hunt for the finish when things are close. And he keeps it on you, man. I like Brad Katona a lot. So I think he's going to be a guy that you'll eventually see work his way back into the UFC. All right, what else we got? BJ Penn, man, flips his truck. And he's being investigated for a DUI. And I don't want to delve too deeply into the personal lives of UFC fighters. But if you look at a guy who was... You have to think about where BJ Penn was at the time, right? Like, in the sport of MMA, he was a legend. He still is. And for him to just, I feel like he identified so strongly with fighting that when that was gone, he didn't really have a way to fill the void. And he kind of, you hear about him getting in bar fights. Now he flips a truck. I don't like to get too into their personal lives, right? Like, I don't want to be sitting up here spitting. I don't know BJ Penn. I don't hang out with BJ Penn. But when you see stuff like this in the news, it's like, ugh. Ugh, that's just how it makes you feel. Like, you don't want that. You don't want to see one of the greatest fighters of all time out flipping his truck in a DUI when his career's over. You want to see them doing things like Brendan Schaub are doing. And, like, if you just watched Rashad Evans on Joe Rogan's podcast, like, that's what you want to see, man. Like, he's so zen, and he's just, like, knows that he has things to still contribute to the fight community. And just, man, when you see stuff like that with BJ, it's sad. Like I said, I don't want to harp on it too long. Like, it's his personal life. I don't want to be this. But it's just, it's a shame when you see shit like that. It makes you feel bad for him. But I think I wrapped up all the shit I want to talk about before this. The scoring was the big one. I mean, I always try to touch on that because, like, I think it's the biggest problem that we have other than weight cutting right now. And I would argue that judge also, the point that I was trying to make earlier is that, like, if you had a more complex system and you upped the requirements for becoming a judge, it would, like, force judges to be competent. Whereas right now, they really can just be like, I think the guy won 10-9. Boom, done. Doesn't make any fucking sense. Anyway, whew. Let's move on and start breaking this main card down, right? First off, you're going to have Yancy Medeiros fighting Lando Venata in a lightweight bout. And the first thing that, like, stands out to me is Yancy Medeiros has some experience at 170, and he's a pretty big guy. We just talked about the weight differences with guys like Douglas Lima and Rory McDonald and Gegard Mousasi. I think that Yancy is going to be the bigger guy in this fight, but here's something to take into consideration. I think that Lando Venata is much more precise and much more technical and much more, his movements are tighter. He's much more compact. He's a little more explosive with his movements, right? And, like, he's one of those guys, though, who, when he's fighting, and, like, if you go back and watch his first round against Tony Ferguson, it was like he was in a flow state, man. It was a thing of beauty. Constant head movement, putting pressure on him, backing up at the right time, slipping out of the way, tagging him with big shots, eating shots too. I mean, the pressure of Tony Ferguson is, like, tough to deal with, but he looked great, man. He almost won that fight against Tony Ferguson, right? And he'll get into these moments where he's like I said, he's in this flow state and he's just, like, throwing shit out there and it's working and he's creative and he attacks from weird angles, but he does have a little bit of a tendency to drain the gas tank to where he can't keep that volume up over the course of three rounds. And I think that what you've kind of seen since the Tony Ferguson fight, because in the second round, Tony put it on him, man. I think that you've seen Lando Venata kind of go through. This is just, I'm not in the fucking camp. You guys are getting a fan's perspective on all this, but I think that what you've kind of seen with Lando Venata is him trying to find the balance between chaos and calm. And he hasn't quite found it yet. If he ever finds it and he can find a steady output and a steady volume and know when to apply power, he's going to be extremely dangerous. I know he's 10-4. He's also got two draws, which is odd, both of them in the UFC. But he's a guy with a ton of potential still. I watch Lando Venata fight and I think, okay, the way that he measures things and his output is his biggest problem, in my opinion. It's not the technique. It's not the skill. It's finding out when to throw things, when to exert power, when to really pour it on guys, when to back off. Once that all comes together, I think you're going to see the best Lando Venata. The problem is if he doesn't have that figured out by this fight, it's going to be an issue because Yancy Medeiros is a fucking warrior. And I think what you're going to see in this fight is a lot of Lando landing clean shots early. And if he's not able to put Yancy Medeiros away early on in the fight, Yancy is a warrior, man. He's got that fucking Hawaiian spear. All those motherfuckers are crazy. I think you're going to see Yancy be able to weather the storm and start pushing forward and hitting Lando Venata with shots that were more significant than what Lando could land. Like I said, Yancy Medeiros, probably not as clean technically as Lando Venata is, but definitely throws volume. I think he'll have a little bit more pop on his punches and is willing to eat a fucking shot. Not that Lando's not, but Yancy, he's willing to go to war, man. Hard to overcome. I know Donald Cerrone knocked him out, but go watch that fight against Alex Oliveira where they were both hurting each other. One of the best fights. I mean, one of my favorite fights of all time, if I'm being completely honest. So wild, so chaotic. If it turns into that type of fight in the second and third round, I think Yancy will have the edge. But in the first round, I think Lando is just going to be able to, like I said, through his technique and through his ability to find openings, things will be there for him. Now, if Lando Venata kind of finds that sweet spot between applying the pressure and conserving his energy, I think that you could see him go in and get a dominant win and kind of pick Yancy Medeiros apart, maybe finish him. Lando Venata is that good, but Yancy Medeiros, tough motherfucker, hard guy to put away. And you saw him struggle in that Gregor Gillespie fight, but Gregor Gillespie does that to a lot of guys, man. Like that pressure, that wrestling pressure just overwhelms you after a while. But I don't think Lando Venata is going to be able to do that to him. I think this is going to be a fight that primarily takes place on the feet. I think this fight has fight of the night potential. And I think it's going to boil down to Lando Venata balancing his output. if it's balanced, if it's well educated, if he's picking shots, he might be able to maintain it over the course of three rounds. But if he like gets drug into a war and a battle of wills with Yancy Medeiros early on in the fight, you'll probably see Lando Venata land more cleanly early, and then that technique and stuff will start to falter as he gets tired and the bigger guy starts to take over. I'm taking Yancy Medeiros in this fight, but don't get me wrong, it could go either way. I think Yancy Medeiros is going to get like a third round knockout in this one. But like I said, a lot depends. I mean, like there are all these different variables in fighting, and if Lando Venata can find that rhythm, he has a very good chance to win the fight. All right, moving on to the flyweights. We've got number 7 ranked Rogério Bontorin, who is 16-1 right now. He's currently riding like a 7-fight winning streak. Do I have that right? Fuck, I can't. I don't know, but he submitted 11 of his 16 opponents. Last loss was back in 2017, and he's fighting Ray Borg, who got back on track with a win over Gabriel Silva. Like I said earlier in the podcast at the beginning of the show, we lost to Casey Kenney, who's fighting on the prelims, and then had that like famous suplex armbar loss to Demetrius Johnson. But Ray Borg is one of those guys, man, who's had kind of like a tumultuous career. He's had problems with missing weight. He got his eye cut in that Conor McGregor incident when he threw the dolly at the bus. I think his kid is sick. I mean, he's a guy that you root for just because it seems like he faces so much adversity, both in his life and in his professional career, right? And the Casey Kenney fight was a little bit of a weird one because you got to see, like, I think Ray Borg came on strong at the end, but kind of let himself get put into some dangerous and like haphazard situations early on in the fight. I think I'm remember. I might be mixing that in the Silva fight up. But I'll tell you what makes me nervous about if Ray Borg has a slow start against a guy like Rogério Bontorin. 11 of his 16 wins have come via submission. Ray Borg is a very talented grappler, very well-rounded mixed martial artist. I think he'll have a bit of an advantage on the feet, even though I'm giving the advantage in the hand speed department to Rogério. But the ability to apply pressure and just consistently put out volume and land probably the heavier shots, I'm giving to Ray Borg. Hand speed and able to land like quickly and like shit like that, Rogério. But the problem is that if Borg doesn't put it on Rogério early and gets himself into a dangerous like situation, the fact that Rogério Bontorin is a finisher might be a problem. Whereas when he was fighting other guys like Casey Kenney, Kenny's not quite the finisher in terms of submissions that Rogério is. Rogério is very talented, and you have to be careful, man, because he's fast. And one of the advantages that like Rogério might have is I think he's like I said I think he has the hand speed. I think if they get into like a war on the feet, Borg is going to edge it out. But with his hand speed, he's able to set things up so well that his takedowns, the timing and stuff of his takedowns are like complemented by his hand speed. So if Ray Borg isn't careful and gets himself into a dangerous situation against a guy who can finish fights, he might lose this fight early on. Like, I don't think that Bontorin is one of those guys that you can wait till the second round to kind of like start taking over. I don't think you can rely on him getting tired because his ability to get you out of there is pretty significant. But this is a tough one, man. Like I said, like Ray Borg seen some of the top flight competition at 125 pounds. And admittedly, this is how I feel about, like, I have a harder time picking flyweight bouts and heavyweight bouts than any other fights in the UFC. Like, at each extreme end of the spectrum, that's where I struggle because the guys at 125 are so fucking, not only are they fast, but their technique is so high level that sometimes I'm watching it and I just can't comprehend the speed that things are happening at. And I'm not able to see what they're setting up because things are happening like boom, 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 where it slows down. Like 155 is not only like the perfect, like fighting weight class, in my opinion, like that's where you get cardio strength. It all comes together, but it's also like one of the most entertaining to watch because like there's a balance. You know what I mean? Like as you move further up, things obviously happen slower and it's easier to read how they develop. But then when you get to heavyweight, it's like, it might be easier to read what they're doing and it might be easier to notice gaps in technique, but there's the unpredictability factor of someone getting knocked out. That's always present. Right? So Flyweight and heavyweight, I always struggle with. Like, I watch it and I'm like, fuck, I don't know who I'm going to pick. I'm going with Bontorin in this one just because, like I said, Ray Borg has had a tendency to let himself get into some tough spots early on. And I think against a guy who's an expert at finishing fights and especially taking your back and sinking in that rear naked choke, I think that could be trouble for Ray Borg early. I think he might let himself get into danger. Now, if he can prove me wrong and get out of that danger, then in the second and third round, he might be able to take over and start to, you know what I mean, flip the script on this guy. But I'm going with Bontorin. But like I said, flyweight and heavyweight, man, two tough fights for me to pick all the fucking time. All right, next we're moving on to a lightweight bout between Kazula Vargas and Brock Weaver. And Brock Weaver is one of those guys who, you know how like you'll watch like some UFC fights or like you'll see a UFC fighter and you go, oh man, if I saw that guy in public, I wouldn't even think anything of him. Brock Weaver is one of those guys who I look at and go, oh my God, dude, he looks dangerous. Like, he looks like a fighter. You know what I mean? I'm like, holy fuck, that guy looks like he fights. He looks like he's got a screw loose. Brock Weaver is 14-4 right now. Went on to the Contender Series and picked up a unanimous decision win in a grueling fight. Landed an arm triangle choke on the opponent before that and then got a rear naked choke on the guy before that in Island Fights. I was able to watch those on UFC Fight Pass, actually. And the thing about Brock Weaver is he's got good stand-up. He's actually got a really firm understanding of distance and, like, managing space, and he's got good timing on his hands. He fights well moving forward and applying pressure and backing up. He counters well, and he uses his hands to set up the takedowns. And once he gets you down, it's kind of like a slow and methodical, like, it's just kind of like a slow burn until he secures position and then submits you, right? And he's fighting a guy in Kazula Vargas who, admittedly, this one's tough to pick because I didn't get to watch a lot of footage on Vargas. He has a lot of knockouts on his record. Lost to Alex De Silva in his UFC debut and really struggled with, like, the grappling aspect, right? Like, he's got a really heavy left high kick and he's knocked a lot of people out. He's got 6 knockouts and 10 career wins. One loss by submission, 2 by decision. Southpaw, which might give Weaver a little bit of trouble. I don't know, man. He's 34 years old. Brock Weaver's 28. It's, I just, like I said, I don't have a lot of footage to go off of with Vargas. But in situations like this where you have a guy who tends to win by knockout, and not only does he win by knockout, but he wins by knockout in, like, lower organizations, and then he gets to the UFC and is not able to replicate that success, it makes it hard not to pick the grappler. I'm going with Brock Weaver. I think he's going to have to take his time in this fight. I think Kazula is going to be very motivated coming off his first loss and exposure to the UFC. I think that Weaver has to be very wary of that left high kick, and just his kicks in general are very powerful. But I think that if he just maintains his range and stays patient and applies calculated pressure, he'll eventually be able to get this fight to the ground. And like I said, just slowly and methodically work his way to a place where he can submit him. I think this fight is going to probably end in the second or third round, and I think Brock Weaver is going to win by submission. But admittedly, like I said, couldn't find a lot on Vargas to watch. I tried looking online, so I might be being a little bit unfair to him. But I really like Brock Weaver's style in this matchup. Like I said, I really like his boxing. I think he'll be able to set the takedowns up. And once he gets his fight to the ground, he's a pretty good finisher. And he's riding a 7-fight win streak in a row, man. I mean, like, he's got momentum on his side. I like that going into this fight. All right, we got a women's flyweight bout coming up next between Montana De La Hoza and Mara Romero Barella. And Montana De La Hoza is one of those girls who, like, every time I watch her, I think, wow, she's improved a lot. Like, she makes strides in her game, and she obviously is a great grappler and a great submission artist. She's got 10 career wins. I think 8 of them have come by way of submission. But she's also making strides in her striking game. Moves her head, throws that jab out there well, and she uses one of the, I mean, this has been a reoccurring theme on this podcast, right? But you have to use your hands to set up takedowns. If not, they're not going to be there. You can't just shoot a shot on someone, right? Like, I mean, maybe you fucking can if they suck or if they don't know what's coming. But you're not just going to be able to go in there and be like, oh, I'm taking this guy down. You have to be able to box. And Montana seems to have a very firm understanding of that concept. I like her head movement. Her footwork is really solid. She's always in position, and she finds great timing for her entries on her takedowns. Able to complete a few of them against Andrea Lee, even though she lost, she really struggled to deal with the jab and stuff that Lee threw at her. But Lee's a vet, and Lee's really good. You saw her fight against Lauren Murphy this past weekend. Good fight. She's aggressive. She has great stand-up. So that was a tough fight for Montana, but she looked confident, and she looked like she was on the verge of being able to pull something off, right? Like, she would land a few takedowns here and there and do a few things right, and Andrea was able to stand back up to her feet or something, right? So Montana De La Hoza, very talented, ranked number 12 right now, and Mara Romero Barella is ranked number 13. Knocked out by Lauren Murphy in her last fight in the third round. It was like a grueling fight, like most of them with Lauren Murphy are. Split decision win over Talia Santos before that. That fight was very close. Santos started coming on strong at the end of the fight. Also, she had Romero's back and like had a rear naked choke sunk in and just couldn't finish it. Like, she was under the chin. And she, I mean, Mara just did a good job of fighting the hands, but that makes you a little nervous against someone like Montana. And before that, lost to Caitlin Chookagian, who recently challenged Valentina for the flyweight title. So she's seen some, I mean, she sees some top-level fighters, man. So that's what makes this fight kind of interesting. But for me, when I watch Mara Romero Barella fight, I think, like, she's very stiff, which makes me a little bit nervous against someone who is pretty fluid. And don't get me wrong, Montana De La Hoza's strong point is not her striking, but it's improving, and it's allowing her to set up things that work very well for her and get her into advantageous grappling positions. I think that Montana is going to be able to use her footwork or head movement. And I just think that you'll see, like, Romero probably packs more of a punch, is probably a little bit stronger, might be able to land a takedown or two in this fight, get on top and apply good top pressure. But eventually, I think Montana is the better grappler. And even if she ends up in these situations, it'll be hard for Barella to get her out of there. Whereas if Montana gets into an advantageous position, she's probably going to be able to secure a submission. I mean, her ground game is very solid. Very good understanding of, like, I mean, she just closes off space so well, and it's so tight. And she's transitioning from, I think it was the Nadia Kasem fight, from triangle to armbar, triangle, arm. I mean, constantly just flowing through things. And like I said, very tight jujitsu, and her hands are coming a long way. So I think that she's going to be able to use her striking to eventually get Romero down. And when Montana ends up in an advantageous position, I think she has a better chance of finishing Mara than Mara does of finishing her, even if Mara manages to take Montana down. So I'm going with Montana De La Hoza second round submission in this fight. I think it'll be a good fight. Like I said, I think Romero Barella might be a little bit stronger. Might be a little bit stronger in the clinch, but you're going to see Montana be more technical, and it'll kind of balance that out. The power on the punches probably belongs to Barella, but like I said, I just think Montana is going to stay fundamentally sound, work behind her jab, use the footwork to set up the takedowns, and eventually she'll get this to the mat and end up getting Mara out of there. All right, moving on. We have got a lightweight bout between – I'm excited for this one because it could go either way. Diego Sanchez and Michel Pereira. And Pereira came out and in his fight against Danny Roberts, which was his UFC debut, bouncing off the cage, ends up knocking Danny Roberts out, hitting him with, like, throwing wild shit, man. And then he fights Tristan Connolly. And he literally just, like, Connolly was on the ground doing that. He's doing the same shit, bouncing off things, doing backflips. And Michel Pereira turned around and did a backflip and, like, landed on his stomach. He just does shit that you don't see. But obviously, and he's built like a Greek fucking god, man. I mean, he's shredded. But you saw Connolly fight behind the jab, stay high and defensive, move forward, just like popping stuff out there, right? And it wore on Pereira because he was using these big movements and these big bursts of energy that weren't actually finishing the fight. And the guy who stayed technically sound and stayed, you know, he just stuck to the game plan and weathered the storm, was able to implement his own game plan later on in the fight. And if Michel Pereira goes out there and does that same thing to Diego Sanchez, yeah, you might knock him out. But if Diego, I'm telling you, I know he's older, and I know that, like, he's just coming off that loss to Michael Chiesa where he got dominated in the grappling department. But look at what he did to Mickey Gall, who's a brown belt I think that if Pejeda comes out and expends all of his energy early, and if Diego stays just, and Diego's a veteran, so he knows how to stay fundamentally sound. If Diego Sanchez stays fundamentally sound in this fight and just boxes this guy, stays out of range of all of his big power shots, which can be somewhat telegraphed. Some of it's very explosive, doesn't see it coming, but when he does big movements, you can be like, okay, the movement's coming. It might be explosive, it might be fast, but it's coming. Diego Sanchez will start to take this fight over and put Pereira on the ground and give him more trouble than Connolly did. Diego Sanchez knows how to fucking grapple, and he'll pour it on you, man. He's very, I mean, I think that, I should back up, because I think that if Michel Pereira comes out and fights a more conservative fight, here's the crazy thing, though, is sometimes when you get a guy like that who's wild like that and you try to control him, he just doesn't fight well because that's how he fights. I don't think he should be doing backflips and shit. I don't think that's conducive of, you know, I don't think that's going to get you a win every time. It might at lower levels, but it's very costly in terms of energy. If Pejeda can just go out and fight like more technically sound Muay Thai styles, like strikes, and put things together and like still explode into things, that explosiveness and that creativeness is what makes him a good fighter. You know, it's what makes him dangerous. But see, you can't take it away from him completely, but he has to manage it a little bit, or he's going to fade like he did in the Connolly fight, and you don't want to fade against a guy like Diego Sanchez. I'm actually taking Pejeda in this fight. I think that you're going to see him calm down. This is a guy in Diego who you should know, or your camp should know, that you have to respect. I'm not saying we won't see flashes of exciting things from him, but I think it'll be a little bit more watered down. And if he conserves that energy and can carry some of his power into the second and third round, he's a way more dangerous fighter. Like, it's kind of like with Lando Venata we were talking about earlier. It's about finding that balance. Where is the balance? If you can't find it, you're going to be fucked. It might work for a little bit, but eventually you're going to get fucked over. If Pejeda can find that balance, I think he's going to knock Diego Sanchez out. If he comes out crazy and pours all... Here's something. This fight could go so many different ways, because Pejeda might say, fuck it. He might get in there and he might see, like, feel the lights, and it's like, it's Diego Sanchez, I'm going to cut loose. And he might catch him, but he might not. But he also might go out and fight in like a conservative shell because he's thinking too much and he's not just throwing. So it's weird always watching these fighters. It's more of like a mental case study about how they're going to decide to let things loose and let things fly. This fight could go so many different ways. If Michel Pejeda is intelligent with his energy output, I think he wins, and I think he picks up a knockout at some point in the fight, because I think the openings will be there for him against Diego. I think he'll be faster, bigger, more overwhelming in terms of power. But if he exerts himself, Diego will take over and win later. I'm going to bank on Pejeda making adjustments now that he's in the UFC and has suffered his first loss. Maybe a wake-up call. I'm going to bank on him making adjustments and winning this fight. But if he doesn't, Diego Sanchez is not the fucking guy that you want to be tired against in rounds 2 and 3. I'm going Pejeda, second round knockout, maybe first. All right, and moving on to the headlining bout, you've got Corey Anderson, who's ranked number 5 right now, rematching Jan Blachowicz after, I mean, Anderson beat him back in 2015, I think, and both guys have come a long way since then. Corey Anderson right now is on a tear, has beaten Glover Teixeira, Alir Latifi, and knocked out Johnny Walker in his last 3 fights. Jan Blachowicz is coming off a split decision win over Jacare Souza in a 5-round main event, which is a big deal because he's fighting 5 rounds against Corey Anderson. And I think in their first fight, you kind of saw that, like, the pressure and the cardio, and this is true for a lot of guys, the cardio and the ability for Corey Anderson to continue to press forward is an issue for a lot of guys. Also, that was Jacare's first jump up to 205 from 185, so, you know, maybe his cardio is a little, I don't know, a lot of different factors. But before that, Jan knocked out Luke Rockhold. Lost to Thiago Santos before that. But Jan Blachowicz, the thing that's so interesting about this matchup is that Jan Blachowicz clearly exemplified that he has knockout power, and he's a really good grappler. He's not as good of a wrestler as Corey, but he's a grappler, and I believe he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I might be misspeaking. He might be like brown. But his grappling is very high level, and he's good. He's good at staying defensive, and he applies offense well as well. I just think that in terms of styles, Corey Anderson has the favorable style in this fight. Because while Jan is a talented grappler, I think that he would probably have to get on top of Corey in order to submit him. Because Corey's a wrestler and he's used to spending so much on time on top that I think it'll be hard for Jan to get Corey out of there off his back. And Corey also has the advantage in that he can probably take Jan down at will more so than Jan would be able to take him down. So I think it's going to be hard for Jan to establish top position on Corey. If he does, if you get a jiu-jitsu guy on top of a wrestler, and Jan will hit some nice sweeps sometimes, but it's hard to do against a guy who has a lifetime of wrestling experience just because the pressure he's able to apply and like his understanding of leverage and stuff on top is so advanced. I don't think you'll see him hit those type of sweeps. If he does, he might be able to get Corey out of there. I also just think that like Corey Anderson reminds me a lot of Curtis Blaydes. Not necessarily like if you saw a silhouette of them, you would tell the difference, but they both just rely on fundamental boxing and forward pressure to set up their takedowns. And they're willing to take guys down over and over and over and over again until they eventually break. And in a 5-round fight, I think that's what you're going to see Corey Anderson be able to do to Jan. I think Jan stays very defensive from a striking perspective. He's a hard guy to put away. You have to really overwhelm him with power. And I don't think that Corey in a 5-round fight is going to be going out and throwing fucking bombs at Jan unless he has him hurt. And I think that Jan is able to stay defensive enough from a grappling perspective to stay safe. Maybe not be winning exchanges, but he'll, in terms of like, he's not, I don't think he'll get submitted. Now, he might get finished with ground strikes, but if he does, I think that'll be later on in like the 4th and 5th rounds. Also, like, Jan knocked out Luke Rockhold, and sometimes when that happens, man, sometimes the hands will just open up. And I know he didn't knock out Jacare Souza, but every time I look at Jacare, I think, like, how could you knock him out? He just looks like if you punched his head, it would be made out of pure fucking steel. Right? Like every part, like how are you going to knock him out? I think he has been knocked out in his career, but you know what I mean. So, I mean, if Jan tags Corey with something and is looking for the counters when Corey's pressing forward, it could be there. But all in all, stylistically, like I said, I think this matchup just favors Corey. I think Corey's going to apply good fundamental boxing, mixing some kicks, some body kicks, leg kicks, back Jan up against the fence, then apply the takedowns. And it's his ability to relentlessly pursue the takedowns, even if the guy gets back up or if the takedowns are unsuccessful, that I think will pay dividends. Because I think as you get into rounds 4 and 5, that pressure that Corey's, it's kind of going to be like John Jones versus Dominic Reyes, except like a different angle from the competitor. But that same concept that if you're walking a guy down and applying pressure and you're able to survive, it pays dividends late in the fights. And I think you'll see that. I'm taking Corey Anderson by decision, but I think if he gets Jan out of there, it'll be in rounds 4 and 5. Whereas I think if Jan gets Corey out of there, it'll probably be earlier in the fight or maybe eclipse him with something at some point that, you know, throws Corey off and he's able to capitalize. But I'm going Corey Anderson, unanimous decision in this one. I just think the boxing, forward pressure, and wrestling are going to be, they're going to be overwhelming for Jan at some point. But I think that wraps everything up. I know this was a little bit of a long one, but I hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you for tuning in. Check out our page on Instagram, MMA.analysis. Admittedly, I need to do a better job of keeping that shit updated. Don't really use Twitter. If you guys like what you heard, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening on YouTube right now, we're also available on iTunes, Google Play Store. I distribute this thing through Anchor, which pushes it out to a bunch of like podcasting platforms. So wherever you guys get your podcasts, if you just look up Mixed Martial Analysis, you'll likely be able to find it. And obviously vice versa, if you're on a podcast platform and prefer to watch videos, I have all this stuff on YouTube as well. So yeah, like I said, if you like what you heard, hit the subscribe button. Leave comments below. I'll try my best to get to them. And thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye.